Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a prolonged protest in the belly of the beast, Wall Street, the female face of poverty in the United States, and ethnic studies police style, putting a whole community under hyper-surveillance.
But first, after 7 months of savage assaults, the air and sea armadas of the United States and Europe have failed to crush an army loyal to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. How could such a small fighting force hold out against NATO and its Arab clients? We spoke with Vijay Prashad, Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
To understand the military history of this region, the best recent example is the so-called Toyota War that was fought in Chad in 1987. At that time, Gaddafi's forces had entered Chad. They had been in Chad for about 10 years already. But in 1987, with French air cover, the Chadian military was able to rout Gaddafi's troops using a very simple and elegant technique, which is that they used Toyota trucks and put on them, heavy artillery guns, and were able to move swiftly in the northern Chadian deserts. And they didn't fear any aerial reprisal because they had French air cover. So in many ways, what one saw over the last several months in Libya was a reprisal of the Chad strategy, where the NATO air cover had made it impossible for Gaddafi's heavy armament to have any kind of impact, because on the ground the rebel army could move very quickly using small trucks. So yes, it was quite remarkable that they held out as long as they could. NATO played a very smart game. They kept drawing Gaddafi out along the Mediterranean road. When the armor would show itself, they would blast it. At the same time, they were bombing in the major cities. So in that sense, that they lasted as long as they did was remarkable. That they have continued to last is not entirely a surprise. There is a section that supports Gaddafi, and that section is in the towns where there is some holdout. And there is a problem, because NATO has threatened to bomb those cities. And we have almost returned again to late February and March with the tide turned. In other words, now there is a serious danger of a massacre in these cities if NATO is going to continue to bomb them. And now nobody is going to go to the UN Security Council and say there needs to be a no-fly zone to protect the civilians in Sirte and Bani Walid.
Will the rebels have a crisis of legitimacy since every single one of their battles has been won, in quotation marks, through NATO's overwhelming air power?
I don't think they will have a crisis of legitimacy. And there, again, we have to go for analogies to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who remarkably in the 1990s, if one met them, I remember talking to some people from the Mujahideen, they were convinced utterly that they had won Afghanistan from the Soviets, regardless of the air power and the assistance from the Pakistanis and the United States government. So there is a remarkable, you might say, adrenaline that kicks in groups like the Mujahideen, and I'm sure in the rebel fighters, that they will deny the value that was given to them, the overwhelming value of NATO air power. Where the actual contradiction or crisis has occurred is between the so-called Benghazi leadership and the troops on the ground. And that we have already seen in places like Tripoli, where Abdul Belaj, who comes from the Islamist section of the rebellion, has the command of the troops, the ground troops, look at people like Belaj and say, you have shed blood with us, we trust you. They look at people like Mahmoud Jibril, the current prime minister, and say, you sat out most of this battle in Paris, you might want to just return there. So there is a great crisis. The crisis is going to be on the ground between the troops, as it were, and their leadership and the political leadership.
From your observations, how pervasive are the Islamists in the ranks of the military?
It's hard to say how pervasive they are in the ranks of the military. After all, yes, a large part of Gaddafi's military had defected very early into the conflict to the leadership in Benghazi. After all, the major military leader in the first several months, Abdel Fattah Younis, was the interior minister of the Gaddafi regime, and he defected with the troops that had come from the western side to liberate Benghazi from the rebels. You know, and instead of liberating Benghazi, he defected to the rebellion. So there are a large number of brigadiers, colonels, a few major generals who defected. Among their ranks, I don't think one will find many Islamists, but certainly among the rebels, you know, there are large numbers of Islamists. And one thing to bear in mind is right through the second half of the military conflict, NATO command and the sections of the political leadership of the rebellion had tried to create a unified military command, to bring all the units under one military command. But most of the rebels did not want that. So what you have is you had a rebel military coalition rather than a rebel military command. And that means that there are many towns where Islamism was prevalent, was the principal political ideology, like Derna, for instance, in the east. And the rebel fighters of towns like Derna are under Islamist command. So that is the situation you have now. You still don't have a unified military command. You have a highly militarized situation, lots of arms floating around, and you have basically the people divided into, you might say, groups of fighters who don't report to a singular authority. That's quite dangerous.
There is no longer any denying the racial aspects of this war.
No, that would be trivial to deny that. It's certainly true that this has been a very racialized conflict, that the migrant workers that have come from different parts of Africa, including the south of Libya, into northern Libya, are heavily discriminated against. And in this war, some of the rebels took advantage of the fact that it was warfare to claim that these migrant workers were mercenaries and kill them. And there's been a lot of evidence of quite brutal killing. But, you know, one thing should be said, that this has been a problem in Libya. And unfortunately, over the last several decades, there has been an insufficient attempt to fight against racism in North Africa, and not only against people of so-called African descent. You know, this is a very problematic thing, because what are we talking about? Are we talking about skin color? Who is an African? These are questions Gaddafi tried to sort out. But he didn't go to the root of Libyan racism, including against the so-called Amharic people, also, I think, derogatorily known as Berbers. There are many cases of very harsh treatment of Amharic people. They are treated as people whose language is banned and made illegal. So I fear that now it is out in the public domain that this has been a highly racialized conflict. And I think there is not enough pressure coming from the paymasters in Paris and Washington on the rebel leadership, telling them that this is not on.
The mostly black town of Tuwerga, which has fallen and basically disappeared from the face of the map, was populated not by people from sub-Saharan Africa, but by black Libyans.
Yes, this is as I said, you know, that in the south of Libya and southwest of Libya, there are many black Libyans. And I mean, this is a major issue that needs to be raised and talked about. And I have not yet seen a Human Rights Watch report on this level of atrocities, not against so-called migrant workers, you know, where the Libyan state has colluded with the Europeans, particularly with the Italians. You know, Berlusconi came to Libya a couple of years ago and gave a speech where he apologized for colonialism, and then he said, what we want is more oil and less migrants. This is not even a question of migrants. These are Libyan nationals who have been treated barbarically. And there is silence in the human rights community. And that does not surprise me one bit.
What effect is this conflict having on the African Union?
Oh, it has greatly debilitated the African Union. I mean, this goes back to mid-March of this year, when there was a split in the African Union. After all, three African countries, including South Africa, sit on the UN Security Council, and all three countries voted on behalf of the Resolution 1973 that was utilized by NATO to bombard Libya. And when those three countries all voted affirmatively for the resolution, it dented the African shield. There is no question about that. There was a crisis in the African Union. There was a debate in the African Union. And I know that Jacob Zuma of South Africa tried to overcompensate by trying to take leadership for the African Union in this particular endeavor. But he was blocked at every turn by NATO command, including he was snubbed when he went to the Russia-NATO summit in Sochi, Russia. The African Union has been treated extremely shabbily in this context, and it's very sad to say that by the three countries voting for that resolution, they have, in a sense, done themselves a disservice. If the African countries had stood together on March 18th and said we are going to vote either against this or we are going to abstain along with Brazil, Russia, China and Germany, if they were going to abstain or vote against it, I think then the African Union could have come out of this with its head held high and said we stood up to what was blatantly NATO's attempt to capture the Arab Spring.
Is there any way for the AU to now save face?
Of course. I mean, for instance, this question we discussed earlier about black Libyans being, as it were, barbarized in the conflict. You know, this is a place, since the Human Rights Watch, since Amnesty International, since all these organizations have been silent about the racialized violence that is occurring, it would behoove the African Union to take leadership here, to send in investigative teams. After all, it is true, there are black Libyans who have been attacked, but also there are African nationals from the other countries. And I'm surprised that there has been not as sufficient public outcry coming from the rest of the African capitals about this kind of violence. You know, it is not on, and they should be taking leadership here. If they take leadership here, they will have to also then confront their collusion with the West in terms of stopping migration. Because bear in mind, many of the African states have walked a long way away from the days of African unity and Nyerere and Nkrumah, and they are colluding with the West, in suppressing their population. So I would say that if we challenge the African Union to take up this issue of the brutality against migrants, maybe it will help them come to a better understanding of how their own citizens are being treated to send back remittances to balance the books of many of their countries.
That was Professor Vijay Prashad at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
The Brennan Center for Justice has been keeping a close watch on the growth of governmental domestic spy networks in the United States. According to the center's Faisal Patel, New York City is home to one of the nation's largest so-called counterintelligence outfits, rivaled in size only by the FBI.
Well, that's right. I mean, the recent stories that have come out from the AP demonstrate, I think, very in great detail that the NYPD has been carrying out a massive surveillance operation in New York City targeting the Muslim communities over here, which number about 800,000 people. So it's really been infiltrating into these communities, looking at where people pray, where they eat, where they shop, and documenting all of these innocuous behaviors.
You know, black folks have been aware that they were being watched for a very long time. The fact that Muslims have come under hyper-surveillance does not necessarily mean that African Americans are out of the spotlight.
That's right. I mean, I think that the two issues are very connected in terms of surveillance of African Americans during the Civil Rights Movement and continuing, I imagine, to some extent. And the other thing to keep in mind, which people actually forget, is that 35% of American Muslims are actually African American. So there's a very large percentage of these communities that is not from the Middle East, not from South Asia, but are converts who have been in this country for years.
We see that 500 police persons in uniform are on this case 24/7, and that they have a budget at their disposal of $93 million. And yet, you say, there is little or no oversight.
That's right. So the NYPD is the largest municipal police force in the country, and its intelligence and counterterrorism divisions are together the largest divisions of this kind anywhere in the country outside the FBI. And the thing that's happened with the NYPD over the last decade is that any rules that constrained them, particularly with respect to monitoring political activity, have been gutted. And there has been no oversight of what their intelligence activities are. So in the federal system, for example, the Department of Justice has an inspector general who looks at what the FBI is doing in intelligence gathering and has on occasion uncovered abuses. The NYPD doesn't have an equivalent inspector general type person. In addition, Congress does exercise some control over the FBI's activities. It holds regular hearings on what they're doing. Congress people have the opportunity to ask questions about these issues. The New York City Council hasn't ever held a hearing on the NYPD's intelligence collection. It did hold a hearing on stop and frisk a couple of years ago, which is a related issue in terms of profiling, although not so much about intelligence collection.
Back in the day, the operative word was subversion, and the government felt entitled to do whatever it felt necessary to combat subversion. Now the term is counterterrorism. What does that cover?
It covers a lot of things. So counterterrorism in this version, the version that's espoused by the NYPD, covers looking into communities to see what people are saying, to see what the rhetoric is, in order to identify what they think of as nascent terrorists. They basically think that anybody who espouses an extreme ideology or has is deeply religious in a conservative way is at a high risk of becoming a terrorist. So they're focusing on a very, very large group of people. But they're not just focusing on Muslims, and we shouldn't get misled by that. I mean, you'll recall that a few years ago, the Republican National Convention was held here in New York, and the NYPD was brought to court because it was infiltrating and monitoring environmental groups and anti-war groups that were planning to protest at the RNC. We know that other police departments in the country have also targeted anti-war groups and environmental groups. So, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves that it's only targeted to one ethnicity. It's basically people who are challenging the established order on some level.
At the center of this surveillance targeting whole communities is something called the demographic unit. Mm-hmm. What do they do?
So the demographic unit, as I understand it, was sent out to map the Muslim community in New York City. And that means, you know, they'll go out into neighborhoods and figure out, you know, where there are concentrations of Muslims. And they'll do that because we don't have census data on this. So they'll do that by looking at sort of, I suppose, the names of people who live in a particular area, the kinds of community structures that are there. Is there a mosque? Is there an Islamic center? Do they have an Islamic bookstore? Apparently, they go so far as to look at restaurants that are frequented by people of a particular faith, or you know, barbershops, hookah bars, sort of, you know, all of the things that you generally find in a community, and they sort of pinpoint them on a map, as I understand it, so that they can see exactly what the concentration is and what businesses and people are there.
Some might worry that that is a prelude to Roundup.
I suppose that's also an option. I think that what it's a prelude for in this instance is really concentrated law enforcement scrutiny. You know, they'll map it so that they know where to focus their policing resources.
Now, this is different than conventional notions of searching out clear and present dangers, which might entail being on the lookout for language that is threatening to the state. But this appears to be a project on which entire communities are looked at in depth, and everything they say and do and their cultural characteristics are put under the microscope in hopes of finding something that might be threatening to the state.
you summarized it perfectly, which is that, you know, generally speaking, we do not interfere with activity that is protected by the First Amendment, which includes your worship and your speech, unless that is a clear and present danger of a criminal act or violence happening. And this is very, very far removed from that. It is, in fact, basically tarring and targeting an entire community.
Now, we also should talk about these fusion centers. I've seen some of the kinds of information that these fusion centers gather, and almost all of it seems to take in activities that only a Tea Party activist could object to.
Well, I mean, the fusion centers, as you know, are basically these combinations of state, federal, and local police resources, which are aimed at both gathering information and at sharing information throughout the system. The problem is that a lot of the information that goes into these fusion centers is actually basically irrelevant. And what we've seen from the few fusion center reports that have been leaked is that a lot of times local police will go out and basically monitor civil rights groups because they somehow perceive them to be a threat. And we saw this in North Texas in the fusion center over there. And there have been a couple of others that have been released that reflect similar patterns. I remember one report in particular of a fusion center which really struck me, where they were monitoring a Muslim group, and the reason that the sort of subversive reason that they gave for monitoring it was that they had used a Girl Scouts troop to organize a Get Out the Vote campaign, which I just thought was just remarkable. I mean, it was this First Amendment protected on top of First Amendment protected, right? They think these people should be watched because they're getting out the vote for an election.
By definition, state surveillance is a slippery kind of subject. It is covert. So how does one combat it?
Well, there's a couple ways to do it. One is we have rules about when surveillance is undertaken. And we had actually a pretty strong set of rules that came out after the Church Committee hearings and the discovery about COINTELPRO and those programs that really, you know, prevented the FBI from collecting intelligence unless they actually had some reasonable suspicion or tip that led them to follow a particular person. Now they can collect information about anybody so long as they think it's related to counterterrorism. The second way in which you deal with surveillance is that you have oversight of surveillance. So you have to have very strong oversight by the legislative body that's appropriate. So in the case of the FBI, the Senate and the House, and in the case of local police departments, the city council must be really robust in how it oversees these activities. And you need to have some kind of inspector general or audit mechanism in place that makes sure that someone with access to the information can actually come up with a relatively neutral judgment on what's going on inside. The third thing, obviously, is for us to sort of take seriously the provisions of our Constitution and our laws on profiling so that we really internalize the idea that, you know, just because somebody looks a certain way or practices a certain religion, it doesn't mean that they're more likely to be a criminal or more likely to be a terrorist. So I think it's really important that we accept that as sort of a founding principle of our system.
That's Faisal Patel of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program in New York.
The protest continues on Wall Street, ground zero of global capitalism. Organizers say they'll keep up round-the-clock demonstrations indefinitely. Larry Holmes of Bail Out the People movement has joined the Wall Street protesters every chance he gets.
I'm very inspired by it. It's an effort on the part of activists to kind of import what's been happening in Madrid, Spain, and Athens, Greece, and Rome, Italy, and maybe even Tahrir Square in Egypt. To the U.S. It's the first major attempt to do that, and it's incipient. It's a first attempt. I think at its numerical strength, it was about 1,500. And one of the things that I'm most excited about is the enthusiasm and the radicalization of a lot of young folks, many of them white kids, college age. We brought down the message of fighting against the execution of Troy Davis. Some of them did not know about Troy Davis, but as we talked to them, it was easy to win them over to this struggle. At one point before the execution, we marched. Everybody in the park marched. There must have been 300 or 400 to City Hall demanding no execution of Troy Davis. So, you know, it's easy to make the links between whatever their consciousness is and maybe some things that they don't know about. And that's important, especially when you consider the potential for unity between the African-American and Latino struggles and this predominantly white manifestation.
For two generations, we've been talking about the belly of the beast. Isn't Wall Street the very deepest belly of this beast?
I think that targeting Wall Street was a shrewd and necessary idea for them. Of course, you can go to Washington, to the White House, to the Capitol, but Wall Street is where the money is. We live in a plutocracy run by the bank, bail out the banks, no one else. Wall Street has become a symbol for greed as opposed to need, and I can see why it was Wall Street, the target of Wall Street, that drew the protests. Actually, as we speak, the markets are crashing, not only on Wall Street, but all over the world. And in my own mind, I kind of think it's a little bit of a demonstration against the lynching of Troy Davis, sort of an unconscious reaction by the financial markets. But it's very good. We're glad that they targeted Wall Street. I hope that soon, perhaps if not with this this time, but later, that labor is compelled to join it. Also, they need to do more outreach to community organizations. Or we could look at it the other way. Community organizations, be they from Harlem or Bed-Stuy or the South Bronx, they need to be the ones that target Wall Street the next time. And if they do it, they will get the best of some of these white youth to come and join them in an occupation with tents and food and all that that involves. I think 2011 and 2012 is going to be a sea change in the level of mass protests and anti-capitalist political consciousness in this country. Not without contradictions, perhaps not on the same level as it is in Athens, Greece, but an important and big step forward.
Are we seeing a growing general realization that Wall Street, physically and figuratively, is the seat of power and should be the center of protest?
It's important what you say about the physical dynamic. As you may know, and this is true especially since 9/11, but all the more so since the global financial markets almost crashed in the fall of 2008, it's hard to actually access Wall Street. You have to go through all sorts of barricades, you're scrutinized, and in anticipation of the Occupy Wall Street protests, they have put up new barricades, and there are lots of NYPD down there and Homeland Security, and large parts of the financial district are blocked off. We have to understand this on a number of levels. Number one, it is an affront to your basic constitutional rights to access symbols and demonstrate against them. Where is it written that the stock market or that J.P. Morgan or Citibank or that the New York Federal Reserve are off limits to demonstrations? But on the other hand, it also demonstrates the considerable fear that the powers that be have about these infamous institutions. They know that people hate them. And I guess they knew that it was only a matter of time for the emphasis of protest and anger to shift away from the so-called Tea Party and target those who are really hurting the masses of the planet, you know, the banks on Wall Street. And that's a huge step forward.
Do you think that the demonstrators have the wherewithal, well, to be there for the long haul?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. There's no doubt in my mind that there is a core group of demonstrators who have come committed to stay there for an indefinite period of time. That core group will be strengthened if others support them. We shall see. Sometimes how this works out is based on events that could not have been foretold. The financial markets around the world are way down, and I think that's going to be very prominent in the media, and there'll be reactions, and I think that will help. I think people will come to Wall Street.
That was Larry Holmes, Bail Out the People Movement in New York City.
Recently released census data show poverty is dramatically on the rise in the United States, with female and child poverty skyrocketing. Timothy Casey is a senior staff attorney for Legal Momentum, the nation's oldest legal defense and educational fund for girls and women. The organization released a report titled Reading Between the Lines, Women's Poverty in the United States.
Since the government started measuring poverty over 50 years ago, in every single year, the poverty rate for women has been substantially higher than the poverty rate for men. In 2010, the poverty rate for adult women was 14.5%, but for adult men, 11.2%. So there's always been a gender poverty gap. That's as a result of women having lower employment rates and lower wage rates when employed. And they have lower employment rates in good part because they're more often full-time caregivers and in part because they still face employment discrimination.
And the programs that we associate with poverty, federal and state programs, are largely female domains, but those programs are shrinking.
Yes. In 1996, President Clinton and Republican Congress passed and the President signed a so-called welfare reform bill that replaced the old National Welfare Program for Families and Children called AFDC with a new one called TANF for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And that's, TANF has been a disaster for poor families. The enrollment of poor families has declined from roughly 3 out of 5 poor families to now only 1 out of 5. And the amount of aid that people who do manage to get in the door get from the program is far below even half the poverty standard in most states. And the poverty standard is itself very low, roughly $14,500 per family of two. And so in most states, if you do manage to get welfare assistance when you're in need, it's less than $7,000 a year for a family of two.
And yet these state and federal officials brag, celebrate, whenever the numbers of people who are enrolled in those programs go down.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, it's a good thing when the welfare rolls go down because there's less poverty and more people getting jobs at good wages. But what's been happening is the welfare rolls went down, not because more people were getting jobs or better wages, but because eligible people, needy people, were no longer getting in the door.
In other words, state and federal programs are deliberately trying to exclude the poor from programs that are designed to help them.
Yes. Welfare reform has really meant trying to reduce your welfare rolls regardless of whether or not the people you're denying assistance to are needy and willing to comply with the system's rules.
We don't hear much about aid to the poor. We don't even hear the words poverty coming from the White House, for example, these days.
No, the national debates, the poor are no longer often, you know, even referenced. And I think the White House has made a political calculation, which may not be correct, that it doesn't aid efforts to get aid to the poor, talk about the poor. So they talk about getting more people into the middle class. The important thing, though, isn't how they talk about it, but what they actually propose. I think under the administration, the food stamp program has done very well. It's expanded as unemployment and poverty have increased. The food stamp program, the rolls have increased significantly in response to the increased poverty and the increased unemployment, and I think the administration deserves credit for that. But in TANF, the rolls have barely increased at all, far less than the increase in poverty and far less than the increase in unemployment. And there, I think both the administration and Congress deserve criticism.
If poverty is so much a female problem directly affecting females, and if child poverty is so directly tied to female poverty, why isn't the women's movement a poor people's movement?
I can't answer for other organizations. Legal Momentum, where I work, is a women's rights organization, and I'm here and working here. I came here many years ago because for us, poverty is a women's issue. And we devote a significant portion of our program resources to working on poverty issues. So I can't speak for other organizations, but I do think that here we understand that poverty is a women's issue, and we try to address it.
But do you think that that is a general thrust among progressives to see poverty as a woman's issue?
Yeah, I think it has been. You know, I think, you know, now historically talked, and still does, talks about poverty as a woman's issue. I think what has happened, though, is that as poverty has moved off the national political agenda, it's harder for organizations to talk about it because the political system is more or less put poverty on the back burner.
If President Obama could take, not one, but two steps towards alleviating poverty in general and poverty among females in particular, what should those be?
Well, obviously, you know, the economy needs to create more jobs, but that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. And I think the most important thing he could do right now in terms of family poverty would be to submit to Congress a proposal to reform welfare reform, to establish national minimum standards in our family welfare program that would enable more poor families to get assistance and raise the amount of aid that poor families get.
And does poverty need to be redefined in terms of income?
The official poverty standard is far below what most people would consider the actual poverty standard to be. So, yes, the poverty standard needs to be revised. It hasn't been revised since the 1960s, other than in response to inflation. It hasn't been revised in response to changes in people's basic and average living standards. And if you did revise it to make it a more realistic standard, many, many more people would be counted as poor. We focus a lot of our attention here on poverty among single mother families. And the poverty rate for single mother families now, it was over 40% in 2010. And that's for the population as a whole, higher rates even for black single mothers and Hispanic single mothers. And single mother poverty now accounts for a majority of all family poverty. A large fraction, at any one time now, over 25% of all children are living with a single parent. 85% of the time, a single mother, and probably up to half of all U.S. children will spend some of their childhood in a single-parent family. So we need to create social policies and social systems that recognize that single-parent families are legitimate families, a legitimate family structure, and they need to be supported. It's this notion that there's something illegitimate and wrong about single-parent families that leads to a lack of support for single-parent and single-mother families in social policy. And almost all the rich countries do a much, much better job than we do in assisting single parents. It's not just in cash welfare assistance. It's more funding for child care. Because one of the big reasons that so many single parents and single mothers are poor is because they can't afford to go to work because there's no child care. And the amount they're going to earn doesn't enable them to pay for child care. So many other countries do just a much better job in funding child care and in raising wages at the bottom of the wage scale so that people who do find a job and are able to work full-time because child care is provided are able to achieve a modest but adequate standard of living. We need to improve our cash assistance program, but we also need to significantly expand publicly supported child care.
Timothy Casey of the Women's Legal Defense and Education Organization, Legal Momentum.
U.S. Census data also show that the number of Americans without health insurance increased by 1 million between 2009 and 2010. Dr. Garrett Adams of Physicians for a National Health Program says more people go without insurance every year, whether the economy is in boom or bust.
The fact is that for almost a decade, we have seen the number of uninsured increase by about 1 million a year. It just doesn't stop, and it's not going to stop. Even after the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented, we expect that there will be probably 23 to 26 million uninsured, about half what is the case now. There will still be millions who are uninsured.
So this is independent of the recent meltdown, part of a larger trend.
The strange thing is that, and this is quite a paradox, the insurance companies, they're siphoning out probably at least 30 cents on the dollar, and that seems to be even going up higher. And now, because of the economy, we're seeing higher premiums because the insurance companies have the ability to raise their premiums, higher premiums, But because the people have less money to spend, they're not even going to the doctor as much, and insurance companies are making even more money. It's hard to believe, but their profits go up and up. And the reason is now because people can't afford to pay their deductibles. They can't afford to go to the doctor, so they're not even using the insurance that they have. So the insurance companies are paying out less in medical care now, and they're raising their premiums at the same time.
And yet this self-rationing, which is what some people are calling it, is being praised as some kind of new normal, good habits on the part of the consumer?
Well, it has a direct effect on the health of the nation itself and on the health of the individuals, because we see people who are not getting the necessary care that they should. Deductibles are keeping them away. The average insurance cost now, I think, for a family of four is about $15,000. And then if you have a $5,000 deductible, and by the time you add all that together, it's going to take up to a third of your income in many instances. And so people are staying home because they can't afford the deductible. And that's the case for middle class people who don't have the money. I'm calling, speaking to you right now from a small community in Appalachia where last year I established a free clinic. I have patients who come to my clinic who are making $12,000 a year. We recently saw a woman who that was her annual income, and she'd not been to a doctor in 20 years. She had an acute heart attack, but she had been staying home. But because it was a free clinic, she was able to come. What we need to do is to make affordable quality health care available for every resident in the United States, because the numbers of those in poverty, as we've seen this Tuesday, going up and up, and simultaneously the numbers of uninsured going up and up, and the nation is suffering.
And this can only happen through single payer, your group maintains.
Single payer would reverse this trend. We would begin to catch up. If we can enact a single-payer national health plan, we will do several things. And I like to put quality ahead of cost, because I think it's important to provide health care. And I think we need to make people emphasize the cost aspect. But the point is that we need to provide the care. We need to make access. We can control costs, so we will improve the quality of care, we improve the availability of primary care, we can plan nationwide, we can follow with this planning, we can improve our control of management of disease. A good example, the best example now is the Veterans Administration. The Veterans Administration system is providing the best health care in the country, which is kind of a surprise to many people. It's better than the Mayo Clinic, better than Cleveland Clinic in terms of following some chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, diabetes. They do a better job because they have their finger on what's going on with their patients. They also have an electronic medical record system so that a patient in McMinnville, Tennessee, which is down the mountain here from me, can go to a VA center in San Francisco and immediately get his health record. And this is what we have in the VA system, what we could have in national system in America. They have that in many of the advanced industrial countries.
I can testify that the VA has kept me alive, but in rightist circles in the United States, that's called socialized medicine.
Some people might say, well, so what? But in fact, what we're talking about is social insurance and not socialized medicine. United Kingdom's system, National Health Service, is a system where the government actually owns the hospital and pays the providers. We're not suggesting in the Physicians for a National Health Program that the government own the hospitals and own the actual sites for providing the care. we would suggest that we continue with private delivery of medical care, but that we have public funding. So it's more, really more accurate to say a social insurance program.
But the VA does own the hospitals and does own the site, and you say they provide the best care in the nation.
That's correct. So it may be the best. Maybe we should go that way, you know. And we have discussions among ourselves as to the possibility and feasibility of more direct health services delivered that way.
Dr. Garrett Adams of Physicians for a National Health Program.
Republican-controlled state legislatures across the country have been busy erecting obstacles to citizens exercising their right to vote. The GOP claims it's fighting voter fraud, but study after study has shown that voter fraud, as described by the GOP, hardly exists. We asked Brenda Wright of the public policy organization Demos what role racism plays in this frenzy of voter suppression.
Unfortunately, I feel like it plays far too much of a role. What we're seeing in the wake of the 2010 elections with the takeover of a lot of legislative houses by the Republicans is the first thing that they've wanted to do is pass a series of vote suppression measures, imposing restrictive requirements for government-issued photo ID, cutting back on early voting, requiring people to bring in documentary proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. You know, it's all coming in reaction, you would have to say, to the huge turnout of first-time voters in 2008 for President Obama's election. And these vote suppression efforts clearly are targeted at the populations that supported him in 2008. And they have their most serious impact on African Americans, Latinos, and people in urban areas that may not have a driver's license, may not have the state-issued photo ID that these laws are requiring. So it's definitely having a disproportionate impact on communities of color and those that have been traditionally disfranchised from the process.
Voter fraud, as the Republicans usually describe it, many studies have shown hardly exists or exists only in negligible numbers.
Yeah, the kind of voter fraud that could be prevented by photo ID requirement is impersonation of another voter at the polls. And that is so rare as to be non-existent. One of the analyses has pointed out that, you know, out of the millions and millions and millions of votes cast, the tiny handful of prosecutions for anything like voter impersonation fraud means that you're more likely to get struck by lightning on your way to the polls than to commit voter fraud when you get there. Voter fraud, typically, when it does occur, it involves insiders, you know, manipulating ballots, or it involves absentee ballots, which these photo ID laws don't have any impact on whatsoever.
Voter suppression could be called a kind of voter fraud.
I think it's a fraud on democracy itself. When you're preventing eligible people from casting a ballot, that is a serious crime against democracy.
Many draw a straight line between today's rash of legislation to suppress the vote and what we saw in the wake of the Civil War.
I appreciate these analogies. It really does look like a sort of second reconstruction, that people have gotten these rights, they've exercised them, and the backlash is just a wave of laws and regulations designed to prevent folks from exercising their right to vote.
You know, it seems kind of ironic that many of the regions, the conservative regions of the country, that are now so in favor of people showing all kinds of ID, have historically been opposed to national ID and intrusions on privacy and government wanting to give everybody a number.
Well, that's true. I mean, the other puzzling thing about it is that in order for any of these laws to even have the possibility of surviving constitutional scrutiny, the states have to provide for free forms of ID. They can't require people to pay, you know, a fee in order to vote. And so these programs are costing these states millions of dollars at a time when state budgets supposedly are strapped, and yet somehow the money is there to impose these kinds of restrictions. It's really got some things backwards in a lot of these states.
What is the anti-immigrant frenzy? What role is that playing in voter suppression?
I think it is having a big impact. There is a lot of fear and misunderstanding out there about the notion that somehow undocumented people are plotting to take over our government by showing up in droves and voting when they're not eligible. In truth, the last thing that an undocumented person wants to do is draw attention to themselves by walking into a polling place or a government office and trying to register to vote or cast a vote. That kind of scenario is fanciful, but people, unfortunately, are singling out folks who look like they come from another country and even engaging in systematic programs through, you know, these organizations like True the Vote to challenge people at the polling place simply based on the fact that they look like they're Latino. And it does create a very intimidating atmosphere for people and keeps people away from the polls who are fully eligible to vote.
Is the Democratic Party as an institution forceful enough in defending the voting rights of one of its main constituencies, black folks and Latinos?
You know, I think there's been a certain amount of disappointment in how vigorous the Obama Justice Department has been on voting rights enforcement. And there's a lot more that could be done. Groups like Demos, the group that I work for, we have filed a whole bunch of lawsuits in recent years against states that are not carrying out their obligations to provide for voter registration at public assistance offices that process benefits like food stamps and Medicaid. And this has just been a sort of epidemic of neglect of this law throughout the country. And we've really been trying to push for the Department of Justice to take a stronger role in some of those litigations. And they're just now beginning to take some action. So we've been a little bit disappointed, frankly, in how vigorous the Justice Department has been on these issues. We think it's very important for the Department of Justice to use its authority under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act to block some of the restrictive vote suppression laws that have been enacted in states that are covered by Section 5. And so there's some that we're going to be seeing, you know, whether that happens in states like Texas and South Carolina shortly, where these applications are pending.
Brenda Wright of Demos, the public policy organization.
Inmates at California's infamous Pelican Bay State Prison were set to renew their hunger strike against physical and psychological torture. As many as 6,500 inmates from across the state took part in a 21-day protest back in July. Inmates say California prison authorities promised to negotiate in good faith, but went back on their word. Dr. Jared Ball, an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report, says great political wisdom often springs from the depths of prison.
Earlier this year, when we received word of an attempt by Maryland prison officials to ban the recently published book by former Black Panther Party leader and current political prisoner Marshall Eddie Conway, we were reminded of the immediacy of the threat ideas can represent to established order. It was a reminder that only specific forms of incarceration and the impact of that incarceration are acceptable for mass consumption. Prison rape, assassination, criminal organization, and all kinds of violence waged by and against guards is somewhat acceptable. Even escapes. Everyone rooted for Clint Eastwood in Escape from Alcatraz, just as we all did for Tim Robbins in Shawshank Redemption. But one aspect of incarceration we are certainly discouraged from truly considering and engaging is revolutionary shifts in consciousness that through implementation threatens not only the order imposed on prisoners, but that imposed on all of us. Defying the Tomb, last year's published book of essays and letters from Kevin Rashid Johnson, is another example of the kinds of revolutionary change some undergo while locked up in this country's prisons, or what Lawrence Bobo calls internal colonies. Unlike Conway's once banned book, Johnson's is not the tale of one previously politicized and incarcerated for that political development in action. Johnson's is one of revolutionary transformation while inside. It describes the particular response some have to imprisonment, both in and out of jail. It describes one man's, actually several men's, grappling with revolutionary concepts, the very ones so many of us nominally free consider immature, passé. But in what world do we live where ideas of revolutionary nationalism, historical and dialectical materialism, anti-colonialism, socialism, communism, and violence have no relevance? What utopia have we achieved with the more acceptable and safe discussions of democracy, free market, pluralism, or indeed post-racialism? In fact, as Johnson describes, the truly oppressive nature of this society creates a tendency to rebel against insufficient change. And this tendency took hold of him, as it does with many of us, long before becoming consciously revolutionary. The endless cavalcade of euphemisms used to deny the on-the-ground reality did little to prevent Johnson from almost immediately rebelling against the disorganized nature of anti-police sentiment, or as he says, "I've always been in something of a running battle with the establishment." But the threat Johnson represents, a threat that has led so many familiar with him to call him this generation's George Jackson, is the threat of organizing around an ever-increasingly radical and well-studied analysis of this society. The threat Johnson represents, one that has had him held in solitary confinement for well over a decade, is his unyielding willingness to continue, as he writes, "studying, refining my views, and testing them in practice." Johnson represents a necessary resurgence of deep study, deep commitment to the people, and the depth of radical ideas. His is a powerful commentary on the failure of that which poses as political leadership in our world today, and the value of the suppressed ideas that, while unpopular, are still correct. After all, it is not simply the similarity in analysis, or the fact that the book contains letters written between brothers, comrades, striving to improve their ideas and organize around them, that begs the comparison to George Jackson. It is the continuity of conditions, or the permanency of the relationship held by black people to the state and the state's relationship to the world. Johnson's book, its argumentation, its conclusions, even his artwork, are further reminders of the incomplete revolution and the failure of our most popular leadership to advance what, as Tom Big Warrior writes in the book's foreword, is the coming revolutionary situation, not because of the actions of the left, but in spite of the left's inactions and decline. Defying the tomb defies more than the incarceration of one man. It defies popular illogic concerning the conditions of the people and what they must do about them. It is a programmatic, ideological blueprint for us all.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.